Welcome to the Patient Education Series of Non-Hodgkin's Lymphoma Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For 20 years, our education group in Miami has been producing cancer education programs for doctors and nurses. On this launch edition of our special patient education series, three nationally respected lymphoma research experts present their approach to discussing this disease with their patients. This audio series can not only be utilized by oncologists, but also by patients who wish to better understand the complex issues surrounding a diagnosis of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. If you're a patient who's received this program from a physician or nurse, or downloaded it from our website, nhlupdate.com/patients, please note that this is not meant to substitute for the individualized opinion that a personal physician can provide. The experts interviewed on this program can, however, be a valuable supplement to understanding this disease and are a credible source of information in the field of oncology. To begin, we visit Dr. John Leonard of Cornell University, who discusses the most common subtype of NHL, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. To assist in this discussion, I asked Dr. Leonard to track through the case of a patient with this disease in his practice.
Not that long ago, I saw a very nice woman who is actually the mother of one of our nurses who is in her early 60s, and she presented with really swollen lymph nodes, fatigue, weakness, just feeling poorly.
How long had she felt poorly?
Felt poorly for probably 2 to 3 months or so before that. Had some shortness of breath that kind of gradually worsened over several months. And fatigue, which is, I think, a fairly common symptom for people with lymphoma. She had seen her primary physician who examined her and felt a lymph node. And he was concerned because he did feel lymph node enlargement. He got some blood work, got some CAT scans, and he sent her to a surgeon who went ahead and did a biopsy of this lymph node.
Where was the lymph node?
Lymph node was in her neck.
How big was it?
It was about 3 to 4 centimeters altogether.
So that's like a couple of inches. Mm-hmm. So was the lymph node itself painful?
It was not painful. It was not painful. And it was something that, you know, she really didn't notice all that much. It was in a location. Sometimes you can see lymph nodes very clearly, but this was in a location where it was kind of hiding. It was in her lower neck, kind of hiding behind her collarbone. And once they pointed it out to her, she saw it very clearly, but she didn't really notice it then.
Now, on the physical examination that I guess her primary doctor did and that you followed up on, were there any other lymph nodes or any other findings when you examined her?
She had some lymph nodes in her groin, and she had some very vague kind of fullness in her abdomen, which I think is also common. She had some lymph nodes in that area, and examining her, it wasn't clear that this was lymphoma, but these kind of fairly vague kind of feeling full at various points and times in her abdomen is something that she noticed.
And when you examined her abdomen, did you feel anything specifically, or was it sort of
no,
distended?
Just some fullness there.
And what did the biopsy show?
Biopsy showed a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma.
And what exactly is that?
There are a variety of different types of lymphoma, and I think one of the hard things for patients is that there are in the range of 30 or 40 different types of lymphomas. There are Hodgkin's lymphomas, which are a special set, and then the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. And within the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, which are more common, there are in the range of 25 or 30 different types. And so it is hard for patients because you may encounter someone with lymphoma or go on the internet or be in a support group or something like that and hear a story about someone with lymphoma. And that may be someone who has a completely different situation than what one is dealing with because they have a totally different type. I tend to group the types of lymphomas, the many different types, into three broad categories, one being the indolent lymphomas, a second being the aggressive lymphomas, and then the third being a grab bag of much less common lymphomas, all of which have their own special type, their own characteristics, their own special features. So diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which this patient had, is the most common of the aggressive lymphomas, which is about 30% of lymphomas.
What's the difference between Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma?
Hodgkin's lymphomas have a particular appearance under the microscope, and they have a particular type of cell called a Reed-Sternberg cell. And Hodgkin's lymphomas are treated also with chemotherapy and sometimes radiation, but they're treated with different chemotherapy regimens than we tend to use in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, so the distinction is very important.
So this woman had what is really the most common form of lymphoma.
That's right.
Now, why is it called diffuse B-cell?
Most non-Hodgkin's lymphomas are B-cell lymphomas. About 90% are B-cell lymphomas. And that is just a characteristic. It's a description of the type of lymphoma and, in fact, where the type of normal cell in the body, the B-cell, is where this lymphoma came out of. Lymphoma is a tumor of the lymph tissue, and the lymph tissue makes up the immune system. The immune system is kind of like the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines. These cells fight infections wherever the body comes in contact with them, and there are switches in the cells that tell them to grow and then tell them to die off. And depending on where those switches get broken, one gets a different type of lymphoma. So this form of lymphoma is a B-cell lymphoma, and it has a pattern under the microscope, which is a diffuse pattern. It's the way the cells arrange themselves within the lymph node, and they are large, hence the name diffuse large B-cell lymphoma.
What do the B-cells do normally compared to what the other types of lymphoid cells, the T-cells, do?
The B-cells tend to develop into other cells called plasma cells, and those make antibodies. And antibodies are liquid chemicals that are released into the bloodstream and help to fight infection. So they provide one arm of the immune system, whereas the T-cells are kind of like the infantry. The T-cells actually go out into the infected area, and they themselves go and fight off whatever needs to be dealt with.
Now, in a patient like this who has a B-cell lymphoma, are her B-cells functioning normally? Can a patient like this be able to respond to infection?
Normal B-cells are present, and so in and of itself, the immune system does work. Patients with any sort of tumor and lymphoma as well, just by nature of having the disease and due to the treatments of the disease, may be at more risk of having infections.
Were there any other studies done on the biopsy tissue, or studies typically done in addition to looking at it under the microscope?
Pathologists will do a variety of different studies to confirm what type of lymphoma we're dealing with. And that's very important. And in some cases, patients should be encouraged to get a second opinion on their pathology, because defining the pathology, the type of lymphoma, is the critical part of deciding what's the prognosis and what's the treatment. And sometimes it's frustrating to patients because they may have to wait a week or two while the pathologist is working on the tissue. They do a variety of different tests on them. One group of tests is called the immunophenotype. And if patients look at their reports, they see all of these CD numbers. And these are the equivalent of saying, what's the hair color of the tumor cells? What's the eye color? What's the skin color? And different patterns of hair color, eye color, skin color fit different patterns of lymphoma. So the pathologist will do these tests to kind of confirm their impression that they see directly under the microscope. And then there are a number of other, what we call molecular tests, that also help to confirm and to look for genetic changes in the lymphoma that help to categorize it and to be sure that it fits the pattern consistent with a given diagnosis.
So now this woman was seeing you as the primary oncologist.
That's right.
And do you have your pathologist then review what the other pathologist has done?
Every patient we see, we have our pathologists review what other pathologists have done. And I would say in our practice, now we have a group, an outstanding group of pathologists, but probably 20 to 25% of the patients that we see, our pathologists have a different diagnosis. And in fact, it's interesting when you look at the original pathologic classifications, the studies that the pathologists did to categorize lymphomas, taking the expert groups of pathologists, getting 10 expert world-renowned pathologists to look at the same tissue, probably about 10% of the time, depending on the type of lymphoma, they disagree. So it's not a cut and dry, black and white issue in some situations. And I think it's very important to get another opinion. Even if it's an expert that's seen it, others may have other opinions that are important to note.
Are there any sort of types of situations where you more commonly see the second pathology opinion differing from the first?
I think that there are certain types of lymphoma where that's more common. In follicular lymphoma and large cell lymphoma, the two most common types of lymphoma, that is less common. But the third kind of grab bag type of lymphomas that I alluded to tend to be more difficult. So for instance, mantle cell lymphoma, small lymphocytic lymphoma, or CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, MALT lymphomas or marginal zone lymphomas, and there are a whole grab bag of names of these things. But these are types that are a little less common, they're harder to sort out, and these, because they're less common, pathologists see them less frequently and may be a little bit less familiar with them. So those are particular scenarios where I think it's important to have another opinion.
Now, in this case, did your pathologist agree with the first pathologist?
This pathologist did agree, yes.
I guess the next step once the diagnosis has been made is to sort of identify where the tumor is located. What was seen in this woman?
This patient had what we call a staging evaluation. She had a bone marrow biopsy to look to see if there was lymphoma in the bone marrow, the cavity inside the bone. She had CAT scans. She had PET scans. And all of these were put together to give us an impression of where her lymphoma was. And in her case, we saw a variety of locations of the lymphoma, both in the lymph nodes throughout the body. She had some involvement of her lung as well as her spleen. So there were a few areas where the disease had gotten outside of the lymph nodes, but was in various organs.
As you talked to her and reviewed her history, you mentioned the fact that she was tired or fatigued. Any other symptoms that you felt were from the lymphoma?
I think that was the most prominent with her. Sometimes people have fever, weight loss. She really had not had those, but I think she just felt like she was kind of chronically run down as her main symptom.
Can you talk a little bit about the specific tests that you just talked about in terms of doing this staging evaluation? First, the bone marrow. What's done in that situation?
A bone marrow biopsy is something that is a simple outpatient test, but there is some discomfort involved with it. Some patients liken it to getting a filling from their dentist in that we numb up the area. It takes about 20 minutes or so.
What part of the body is it done on?
It is done in the hip bone or in the iliac crest, the upper part of the buttock area, the bone in the back.
So the patient lies flat, prone, face down on the table?
That's right. Patients lie on their stomach. There is some cleaning solution to make the area sterile. There's some numbing medicine, that usually lidocaine, that's applied to the skin and to the bone using small needles. And then basically the person performing the procedure goes into the hip bone a couple of times with a needle and samples the area inside the bone. There are a few areas, a few times, a few seconds here and there, where there is some significant discomfort because we can't numb up the whole area. But the procedure is done with in about 20 to 30 minutes or so, and it's not a very dangerous procedure, which is reassuring to some people despite its discomfort.
In this case, what was seen in this woman's bone marrow?
This woman did not have any involvement of her bone marrow. Bone marrow involvement is very common in the indolent forms of lymphoma. In large cell lymphoma, which she had, it's seen in the range of about 10 to 20% of patients.
Now, you mentioned also the CAT scan and the PET scan. What are these?
CAT scans are fancy x-rays, basically, that allow the radiologist to look at pictures of the organs and the sizes of the organs and the consistency of the organs inside the body. So it's basically looking at slices of the patient going down the body from the head to the toe. And that allows us to look to see, are there areas of lymphoma involvement in different organs? Are there lumps in the different organs? And more commonly, look at the size of the lymph nodes and are there enlarged lymph nodes. Normal lymph nodes are about a centimeter to a centimeter and a half in size. So if we see a lymph node area that's about 5 centimeters, let's say, we assume that that's lymphoma because it's enlarged. The PET scan is a different sort of test. It's a complementary test. PET scans involve a small injection of radioactive glucose, radioactive sugar. And radioactive sugar, or sugar in general, is taken up by tumor cells as well as some other conditions like inflammation. And so this is kind of a double check of the CAT scan, that this area, this test, lights up in areas that appear to be involved with lymphoma. And so the CAT scan is better at giving size of tumor masses, whereas the PET scan is better at picking up the number of tumor masses and areas that perhaps might be still small but are involved with lymphoma and therefore not picked up on the CAT scan.
Now, you mentioned that this patient had involvement in the lung. Could you see that on her regular chest x-ray?
You could see that on her regular chest x-ray,
yes. Where in the lung was it?
It was in the upper part of her right lung.
And it was seen also in the PET scan and the
CAT
scan?
That's right.
So was this a majority of the lung that was involved or just a small part of it?
No, this was a small area. The two lungs together take up most of the chest area, and this was an area that was maybe the size of a golf ball.
I'm curious about sort of this woman's emotional reaction to this situation. How did she appear to you?
I think she was worried, as anyone would be, because it's obviously a scary thing to be facing this sort of diagnosis. I think to some degree she was also relieved to know that because she'd not been feeling well, she was relieved to know that she had an answer to why she was not feeling well. And I think to some degree relieved that we have good treatments for her, and she was optimistic that she would feel better soon.
Now, is she working?
She's retired. She's active, though, has an active social life and visits with her family, goes out with her friends, is very active in her social circles.
Is she married?
She is married.
Who came into the office when you met with her?
Her husband and her daughter came in.
I would imagine that one of the things maybe that might have come up in this conversation was, why did she get the lymphoma? What do you say to patients about that?
We don't know why patients get lymphoma. It's complicated, and it's particularly concerning because the incidence or the number of people who are getting lymphoma seems to be on the rise. Lymphomas have been associated with people with problems of the immune system. So patients who have immune deficiency states, whether it's from some infection like HIV or from other more rare immune problems that are occasionally seen, that's been associated with lymphoma. But most people with lymphoma really do not have a definable risk factor. They don't have a definable reason why the lymphoma seemed to occur.
Are lymphomas in any way communicable? I mean, should her family or husband be concerned about that?
It is uncommon, but there are family members of patients with lymphoma who do develop lymphoma. So like most cancers, your risk of having a cancer tends to be a little bit higher if you've had a family member. So there are some what we would call genetic, perhaps, relationships, but there's no evidence that they are, in fact, communicable or that being around a patient with lymphoma is going to result in getting one.
How strong is the genetic connection? For example, should her daughter be concerned?
The genetic component of lymphoma overall seems to be relatively low with respect to family risk and family history. So other than routine medical care and medical screening, we would not generally do anything special as far as screening for a family member of a patient with lymphoma.
In breast cancer, we have mammography, prostate cancer, the PSA blood test, colon cancer, colonoscopy. Is there anything that can be done to pick up lymphomas earlier, or is it of any value?
It's hard to know whether or not picking up a lymphoma early would make a difference in outcomes. There are some hints that that would be the case, but overall, it's hard to really argue that that would make a big difference. And so in general, there aren't any particular screening tests other than getting routine checkups with one's doctor. And obviously, if one has a symptom which could be seen in lymphoma, fevers, weight loss, night sweats, or lymph node swellings, that would certainly be a reason to go see one's doctor and have that checked out.
What were the options of therapy that you discussed with this woman?
Well, when I see a patient with large cell lymphoma, the type of lymphoma that this woman had, we sit and talk about what's the prognosis and what are the treatment options. And in large cell lymphoma, going back several decades, we have something called the International Prognostic Index. And it's a very simple index. We remember it by APLES, or apples is a way to remember it and think about it. And that is really five features that tells us how a patient is likely to do. Now, none of these things are perfect, none of these tests are perfect, but it gives one a rough idea as to, is a patient going to do better than average, maybe worse than average, or somewhere in the middle. Large cell lymphoma is a curable lymphoma, and so the goal of treatment with large cell lymphoma is to give the treatment, which is primarily chemotherapy, occasionally radiation therapy is part of it, and now rituximab is a common part of it. But the question is, for the individual patient, what is the likelihood of that type of treatment working for them? So the International Prognostic Index is a simple five-factor tool that we use, and I sit with every patient and go through it with them just so we get a sense of what to expect out of their disease. The first two factors are age and what we call performance status. Patients who are older, over the age of 60, has been an arbitrary cutoff, and that's very arbitrary, and have what we call impaired performance status, meaning they're sick in bed and unable to walk around and do their normal activities, are less able to tolerate the disease, less able to tolerate the treatment. So patients who are older and bedbound or unable to do their activities do less well. So those are two of those five factors. The other three factors reflect the biology of the disease to some degree. Those second three factors are what we call the LDH, or lactate dehydrogenase, which is a blood test that can be easily measured through a routine blood test and really shows the turnover of the cells. It shows how fast the cells are growing. Having an elevation of the LDH is less good. Having multiple sites of what we call extranodal disease, that's the E in the APLES, extranodal disease suggests in more than one place, such as the lungs, the liver, the bone marrow, suggests that the disease is acting a little bit more aggressively and that it's leaving the lymph nodes and going into other areas. And then what we call stage 3 or 4 disease, when we have disease, and that's the S or the last factor, if the disease is in various areas of the body, both above and below the diaphragm or the waist area, that would make it stage 3 or stage 4. And so those five factors give us a sense of whether a patient is very likely to be cured, less likely to be cured, or somewhere in the middle, and gives us a sense for an individual patient of perhaps what we can expect out of this disease and how we should approach them. So a patient who is young, who has disease and is ambulatory, feeling well, doing all their normal things, who has a normal LDH, the disease is only in the lymph nodes and maybe in only a couple of areas, those are patients who are likely to do very well with standard treatment.
Very well, what do you mean?
Well, cure rates for aggressive lymphoma in patients who have none or very few of those risk factors are in the range of 80% or so. Other patients who have more of these risk factors, so let's say an elderly patient who is sick in bed, who has a high LDH blood test, and has disease that's in various areas outside the lymph nodes, may have cure rates that are much lower. In some cases, that can be in the 20 to 30% range. And then other patients are somewhere in the middle.
And when you say cure, this is primarily with chemotherapy and rituximab?
That's right.
What were the IPI or APPLES findings in this woman, and what did you tell her about her chance for cure?
This patient had multiple adverse or poor risk features. She was over the age of 60. She was up and around, so she had a good performance status. She did have an elevated LDH. She also did have multiple sites of the disease outside of the lymph nodes, and she had stage 4 disease. And so when I talked to this patient about her disease, and we talked about the fact that CHOP chemotherapy and rituximab antibody therapy being the standard treatment for this situation, however, this was not something that, while CHOP and rituximab could be very effective, given the fact that she had multiple poor risk factors here, I was worried about this lymphoma, and I was worried that that therapy might not be enough to cure her disease, and that there was a significant risk that because of these risk factors, that this therapy was not going to be enough for her, and maybe we should think about doing something more.
Now, understanding that it's probably pretty hard to give an exact number, in your mind, what was the likelihood that she would have been cured with the rituximab antibody and CHOP chemotherapy?
I think less than 50%, certainly less than 50%. And, you know, patients and doctors sometimes want to talk about these percentages. I think it's hard to know. We see patients who have a 95% cure rate, but if you're the 5%, you're very unhappy. And if it's a 5% cure rate and you're the 5%, you're very happy. So I tend to look at those sorts of numbers, which some people like to have, as to, you know, are our chances of success good, and therefore we should probably stick with the standard treatments and, in fact, make sure we do them very well and try to minimize long-term complications because we think there's a good chance that the patient is going to live a long time? Or are we not happy with what we expect out of this treatment? Should we think of something more, giving the treatment in a different way, a more intensive way perhaps, or doing a clinical trial with a new drug as part of the treatment to try to improve those outcome possibilities? And I think that she felt strongly that she wanted to do everything she possibly could to A, get better, and B, be cured of her disease. I think it's hard for patients. Doctors tend to be overly optimistic about this. And when we see large cell lymphoma and we know that we can cure it, we tend to overestimate things because it's not fun to say to someone, you're not likely to do well. And so we tend to be overly optimistic and say, well, if there's a chance or a reasonable chance, you know, let's plan to do it. But I think it's important for patients and doctors to understand what the percentages are. And in fact, there are some cases where, yes, despite the fact that it is a curable situation, the chance of actually getting to a cure may be relatively low. And we really need to think hard about doing something more.
You know, it's interesting to see how oncologists in different kinds of tumors approach situations. In breast cancer, they actually have computer models where they generate specific numbers, and they often actually show them to patients. As I listened to you describe this situation, particularly as you went through the factors and the mm-hmm. fact that you had so many adverse factors, rather than the specific number, I would have been getting the feeling from you, hey, you know, maybe we need to think about doing something a little bit more intensive to try to bring those numbers up.
That's right. And that's what this woman said. she said, well, that's good that you can cure it, but is there something more? I'm not satisfied with those odds. I'd like to do something better.
And so what did you bring up then?
Well, we talked about the fact that there are a variety of different approaches that have been done to try to improve the outcomes with CHOP or CHOP rituximab-based chemotherapy. One approach is to give the treatment every 14 days rather than every 21 days. That adds some toxicity to it, the blood counts in particular. You have to use drugs to boost the white cells to give it on an every 14-day rather than every 21-day schedule, which is the usual schedule for CHOP.
And that's the
one approach.
That's the dose-dense chemotherapy approach, because that's used a lot again in breast cancer.
That's right. That is used in breast cancer.
So normally, can you go through then what a typical rituximab CHOP kind of schedule would be and how that would be different with this dose-dense approach?
Sure. This treatment is generally given, CHOP and rituximab are generally given as an outpatient. Patient comes into the doctor's office, has an intravenous line started. They may get some nausea medicines to prevent nausea as part of the treatment in the vein and by mouth. The nurse hooks up an IV. The drugs drip in over various periods of time. Cyclophosphamide, or the C in CHOP, drips in over about an hour or so through the vein. Adriamycin, or hydroxydonamycin, which is the H, is in a syringe. It's a red drug that's injected through the intravenous over the course of about 15 minutes. Oncovin, or vincristine, O, is given in the vein. It's a yellow drug that's given in it through a syringe in about 15 minutes. And then P is prednisone, and prednisone is taken by mouth for 5 days with each round of the treatment. So on day one, the patient gets the four drugs, three of them in the vein and one by mouth. The addition of rituximab to this involves another drug. The rituximab is an antibody-based treatment that drips in over the course of 4 to 6 hours. So rituximab takes a bit longer to give, and it turns it into pretty much kind of an all-day treatment or close to an all-day treatment. And that's administered, the whole CHOP-R regimen is administered typically for 1 day every 21 days, usually for 6 treatments, so it's given about 4 months. In the CHOP-14 schedule, we're giving it more often to try and give the cells less of a break in between the treatments, and we're giving it every 14 days rather than every 21 days.
I would like you to dissect out a little bit about how each one of these parts of the therapy might add side effects. Let's start with the prednisone. Now, that's a steroid, a cortisone-type drug.
That's right. Prednisone is a pill. It can sometimes irritate the stomach. It can sometimes make people feel a little bit moody. Many people may be familiar with prednisone because it's used for other diseases, particularly allergic reactions and autoimmune diseases, asthma. Sometimes people are familiar with it. It can sometimes elevate the blood sugar, so it can be an issue in people with diabetes. It can sometimes make people feel a little bit manic or a little bit energetic while they're taking it, and then when they stop it, feel a bit less energetic.
And what about the chemotherapeutic agents, the Cytoxan, Adriamycin, and Oncovin?
They have a number of different side effects. These are outpatient treatments, and I typically tell patients, and it depends on the situation, that most patients are 70 to 80% of their normal self while they're on chemotherapy. Some people are better than that and are able to work and do most of their normal activities. Others are more affected by it and kind of have to shut down or to lower their activity level. Fatigue is an issue with these. Adriamycin, or the hydroxydonamycin, does cause hair loss, and so that's something that we typically see with this regimen. They affect the blood counts, and that's why we wait typically 21 days in between the treatments to let the blood counts go low and then come back up. And when we use it particularly on the 14-day schedule, we have to give medicines to help the blood counts along to boost up the white cells in particular to minimize the risk of infections. Oncovin can sometimes cause numbness and tingling of the fingers and toes, what we call neuropathy. It's important that patients drink lots of fluids while they're on chemotherapy to flush their kidneys and flush their system. The rituximab treatment is generally given with Tylenol and Benadryl. The main side effect of that treatment is that people can get what we call infusion reactions, fever, chills, shakes, that occur while they're receiving the treatment, not so much when they go home. And that's something that is more common the first time the patient receives the treatment and less common thereafter.
Let's dissect out a little bit more some of these side effects that you discussed, beginning with the last one, the infusion reaction. How severe is it? And generally, are patients fine once they leave the office?
Usually these are mild to moderate symptoms. Occasionally they can be more severe. It's something that nurses are very comfortable with dealing with when they occur for an individual patient. They usually stop the treatment. There are medicines that we can give. Some patients just sleep through the treatment and sit and relax and, you know, read or watch a movie or watch TV. Others are more affected by it.
And does the rituximab cause any of the chemotherapy-like side effects, the hair loss, nausea, et cetera?
No, the rituximab does not cause those symptoms. It's interesting in that the studies that compared CHOP versus rituximab plus CHOP really showed no major increase in side effects when you add the rituximab. So it's striking that the rituximab doesn't worsen, in general, the things that the chemotherapy does.
Now, these reactions that occur, is it similar to an allergic reaction or kind of like having the flu? What does it sort of feel like?
It's kind of like those symptoms. People can feel cold. They can have chills. Sometimes they get a little short of breath and just kind of feel achy, shivery would be a description of it. They typically happen while the patient's there. So it's not something that typically happens on the way home or the next day, but really while the patient's in the doctor's office. And because it's generally predictable, it's something that everybody there is used to dealing with. While it can be a little bit scary for the patient sometimes, in general, it's very manageable and not a life-threatening thing.
What fraction of patients have no infusion reaction initially, and what fraction, once you get out to 2, 3, or 4 cycles, are still having no problems?
Over half the patients will have some sort of reaction, but most of those are mild and manageable. You get down to a much smaller percentage, maybe 20 or 30%, as patients get through their further treatment.
Now, you mentioned hair loss, but particularly as it relates to the adriamycin. What typically happens? When does it start? How much hair is usually lost in this situation?
With this regimen, patients usually lose all of their hair, at least the hair on their head. There may be thinning of the body hair elsewhere. Usually, this takes about a month to happen. Patients will notice on the pillow or on a brush that their hair is coming out. And then when the treatment stops, usually within a month, it starts to grow back. Again, obviously very short, and then longer thereafter.
What fraction of patients have complete loss of hair in their head, and what fraction have none at all?
It really depends, and that's something that patients ask a lot about with chemotherapy. It really depends on the chemotherapy regimen that one is using and the doses that one is using. With the CHOP regimen, because of the adriamycin is the most important drug, and so we don't like to delete it, but adriamycin is the one that really causes that particular side effect, and so pretty much everyone has near complete hair loss.
What about nausea and vomiting? I know we have a lot better drugs nowadays to prevent that, and patients receive these kinds of drugs. In spite of that, what fraction of patients have problems with nausea and vomiting?
Most patients have some symptoms of at least nausea. We have medications that we give in the vein and by mouth to help prevent that. And when patients go home, they usually take some of these medications for a couple of days. I would say that most patients, their symptoms are with this regimen. And again, it's very dependent on which chemotherapy drugs we're giving. But with CHOP, the adriamycin is the drug, again, that's most important. And that is the one that's most prone to give nausea. With this regimen, usually patients eat lightly for a day or so around the treatment. Maybe they have a little bit of nausea. It's pretty uncommon for people to have, you know, vomiting where they can't leave the bathroom and are having major symptoms. And if that's something a patient is having, that may happen, you know, under 20% of the time. If that's something that patients are having, they really need to speak with their nurse or their doctor, because there are lots of different tweaks to the medications that can be done to prevent that.
Now, you mentioned that there's this newer approach using the therapy every 14 days. When this approach is utilized, are the side effects worse or different?
Side effects are a little bit worse, particularly with the blood count. So we have to help them along with these extra drugs, what are called growth factors, to help boost in particular the white cells to get them back up in time to give the next cycle of chemotherapy.
How about the other side effects, the fatigue or the nausea, vomiting, et cetera?
Those side effects may be a little bit worse with this form of treatment also.
Now, how does the rituximab and the chemotherapy work and the prednisone work against the tumor cells? How does it actually affect them?
It's hard to fully understand how all of these treatments work. Chemotherapy affects rapidly dividing cells, and the tumor cells are among the more rapidly dividing cells. Some of the side effects of the chemotherapy, such as the blood count toxicities, occur because the precursors to the blood cells in the bone marrow also are dividing, and so those could be affected by the chemotherapy. Different chemotherapy drugs tend to work in different ways to some degree, and so by giving them in a combination, you can kind of overcome the tricks or some of the tricks that the cell has to avoid the chemotherapy or to outsmart the chemotherapy by coming at it kind of with different directions in different ways. Rituximab works in a variety of different ways to kill tumor cells. It can work with the immune system to induce an immune response against the tumor cells. It can also flick switches in the cells. Something that we call apoptosis is just a term, the scientific term that's used to describe this. But that flicking of the switches can tell the cells to die and not continue to grow. And there are some complicated ways where it appears that rituximab may sensitize the cells to the effects of the chemotherapy and in effect make the chemotherapy work better.
My take is that rituximab is part of a wave of a lot of new therapies that sort of fall under the title of targeted therapy. They're more specifically targeted against tumor cells than chemotherapy. Is that your take?
Yes, I think that's the intention. And I think our goal is really to target the treatment towards the tumor cells to have maximal effects while minimize the targeting to the normal cells, which results in the side effects.
So one option for this patient would be to get the conventional R-CHOP given every 21 days for 6 cycles. Mm-hmm. A second would be to get it every 14 days. Now, what do we know about the potential benefits of giving it every 14 days?
There have been some studies that were done, particularly in Europe, that used CHOP. This was before the R-CHOP became more standard, that suggested that CHOP alone on the 14-day cycle was better in some patients versus the CHOP alone on the 21-day cycle. We're still learning whether the addition of rituximab changes this in any way or perhaps doesn't change this in any way. We are still learning whether now that we use rituximab quite commonly in the treatment of this disease in combination with CHOP, whether or not the improvements that we're seeing in the 14-day versus the 21-day schedule still hold up.
So is that an option that you've utilized in some patients, and did you present that as a possibility to this woman?
We discussed that, and that's something that we are looking at, and in some patients we do use that approach in certain situations. We had a particular clinical trial that we discussed and what this patient ultimately decided to pursue with her treatment, and this trial used the R-CHOP on the 21-day schedule in conjunction with a new agent that we were adding to try to improve the outcome.
So this was an experimental study that you were doing at Cornell?
That's right.
And what was the agent and how was it utilized in the study?
The agent in this study is a drug called bortezomib or Velcade. Velcade is a drug that's FDA approved for treatment of multiple myeloma. Multiple myeloma is a lymphoid tumor or a lymph tumor that in some ways is related to lymphoma, but it affects more the bones and the bone marrow. Bortezomib has a complicated mechanism of action, but what it does, it is a class of drugs that are what we call proteasome inhibitors. And proteasomes are organs inside cells that play a role in how the cell gets rid of things it doesn't need anymore, proteins that it doesn't need anymore. And so by inhibiting the proteins using a proteasome inhibitor, such as bortezomib, you change the balance of certain proteins in the cell. One of the important proteins in lymphoma and in other cancers is called NF-kappa-B. The name is not that important, but NF-kappa-B is a substance that might help let cells be resistant to chemotherapy and help keep them alive. So the concept behind this protocol is to give the bortezomib, which lowers NF-kappa-B levels in the lymphoma cells, to make the chemotherapy work better. That's the theory behind it.
So you were doing a sort of a preliminary study to see whether or not you could add in the bortezomib to the R-CHOP.
That's right. That's right.
And at that point, when you discussed it with her, what had you seen already with other patients?
She was one of the first patients to go on this study. And we have a lot of experience with bortezomib or Velcade in other settings, using it by itself, particularly in multiple myeloma. And there had been some studies with chemotherapy, but this is one of the earlier ones. And so we had treated a couple of patients on this protocol, and we had a pretty good idea of what to expect. But with any study, this was a relatively new combination. And part of the goal of the study was to say, can you give these drugs together? What is the right dose? What are the side effects? And how well does it work?
I'm sure she asked you how likely it was that she'd have more side effects or toxicity by adding in this additional agent. How did you respond?
Bortezomib, because it's FDA approved and it's been given to thousands of patients, we have a good idea of what its main side effects are. And those include neuropathy, numbness and tingling of the fingers and toes, and what we call thrombocytopenia, or a drop in a specific type of blood cell, the platelet count. And so those were the main side effects that we were worried about, in fact, because the R-CHOP regimen, in particular the chemotherapy, can also cause some of those problems to some degree. So we told her that it was possible, and we were being very cautious in this study, it was possible that some of those symptoms might be worsened because we were giving different sets of drugs that could cause similar side effects together, and therefore the end result might be more in the way of toxicity. And so we discussed this issue. We also told her that we couldn't be sure that other new side effects couldn't come about that we weren't expecting, and that's why we're doing the clinical trial. But we were concerned enough about her lymphoma and the fact that we thought we needed to do something more, plus we were encouraged enough by the potential promise of this new combination that we thought it was an important consideration for her and an option that was worth pursuing.
Now, bortezomib is available. Physicians can prescribe it. Is this approach combining the R-CHOP and bortezomib something that any physician could do in practice, or really needs to be done as part of a clinical trial?
Theoretically, oncologists can prescribe drugs outside of their FDA indication, and so a drug approved for another indication, another situation, could be used in a variety of different places. Whether or not insurance companies would pay for that and deal with the cost of that is another issue. Because this is a new combination, this is not something that I would do outside of a clinical trial, but something that I think is important to study. And perhaps ultimately, depending on how this goes as far as safety and efficacy, it may be that we will have trials that would, down the line, potentially compare R-CHOP versus R-CHOP plus the bortezomib.
Now, when a study like this is done, I know that there's a sort of an external review of it to determine whether it's safe, whether it's ethical. I'm sure that was done in this case. Was that explained to the patient, and are there forms that they're going through to go through that?
Any clinical trial follows what's called a protocol, where the doctors who are doing the trial and the whole group that is doing the study outlines in advance what they're going to do, how they're going to do it, why they're going to do it. And they include a consent form, which is in some cases a long document, but goes through all the details of the disease, the treatment that's planned, and the potential toxicities that are anticipated, and explains to the patient what the situation is, why the doctors, why the investigators are doing the study, what they can expect out of it. And the point is to be sure that patients understand what exactly is it involved, why should they consider this study, and what are the potential downsides of this study? Because by definition, any study is not a certainty. We're learning about a treatment regimen and hopefully how it can help patients.
Now, do physicians who participate in clinical trials like this benefit financially?
The way that clinical trials are supported is complicated. There are a variety of different clinical trial mechanisms. Some clinical trials are done and are sponsored by the National Cancer Institute. Many trials out in the community are done through what are called cooperative groups, where the National Cancer Institute organizes groups of both academic and community centers to do trials together, to answer big questions about how does one treatment compare to another. Some trials are organized and are what we call investigator-initiated trials, such as this one. This is one that our group at Cornell developed and approached. Other trials are conducted by pharmaceutical companies or biotechnology companies who have new drugs that they are trying to develop or trying to better understand. And those may be supported by companies who primarily provide support for doing the study to cover the costs of treating the patient, the nursing personnel, and keeping track of all of the data in the study. Every study that goes on has a complex series of regulatory pathways and issues that need to be dealt with. And there is a very extensive monitoring of what's going on, the side effects, and to be sure that everything is being followed in the most appropriate way as far as the treatment program.
So, for example, in this study, were you deriving any specific revenue by this woman going on to it?
So I personally did not derive any revenue. The Cornell Medical College received some support for this study to help to pay parts of the salaries of the people that are working on this and to pay for their activities working in conducting this research.
So you discussed the option of R-CHOP dose dense every 14 days mm-hmm. and this clinical trial. Any other options that you brought up to her?
We also discussed the issue of autologous stem cell transplant. Autologous stem cell transplant, or a stem cell transplant from oneself, is a fancy way to give more chemotherapy. And it's a long discussion as to how this works and what's behind it. But the gist of it is that some of the bone marrow-derived stem cells, the cells that give rise to the blood, can be removed from a patient through a simple procedure like a dialysis procedure and put into the freezer and stored. And then the patient can receive high doses of chemotherapy, enough that would drop their counts down to a degree that would keep them low for several weeks, if not months. And then the stem cells are given back like a blood transfusion. In short, this is a way to give more chemotherapy, to escalate the doses of the chemotherapy, but to try to minimize the blood count toxicities of this extra high-dose chemotherapy. This procedure is something that is done in relapsed large cell lymphoma. So if this patient were to relapse from her disease, this might be something down the line that we can consider as a way of giving additional chemotherapy. And some patients can have their disease cured by this sort of procedure. So some studies have looked at, and some people have looked at, the idea of doing this in high-risk patients right after the CHOP or Rituxan, not waiting for someone to relapse, but kind of as a 1-2 punch to give the CHOP and Rituxan to get the disease into remission, and then the stem cell transplant to try to knock it out even further. That's a debatable issue. There's actually a large trial going on right now in the U.S., a trial by one of the cooperative groups and the National Cancer Institute, looking at taking high-risk patients, much as this patient is, and looking at it in a randomized way, taking them and giving them R-CHOP in the standard every 21-day schedule, and then randomly assigning them to observation versus autologous stem cell transplant in first remission to see, do the patients who get the autologous transplant in first remission do better? And so that's an important study, and that's something that we also talked about with this patient.
So she decided to go on the R-CHOP bortezomib study. Why do you think she decided that?
I think she wanted to do something more for her disease, and I think the idea of this form of therapy and the rationale behind it, without adding a lot of expected toxicity, although we can't be sure, that's why we're studying it, we did not expect that she would have major side effect problems from this, but that it offered a potential way to make the chemotherapy work better, and that was appealing to her.
And what happened?
So she received the treatment. She tolerated the treatment very well. She finished her therapy somewhere in the range of about 6 months ago. So she started all of this in the range of about a year ago. She went into remission with the treatment. We monitored her with CAT scans and PET scans and laboratory work and physical examinations. And she went into a full remission and has been in remission since that time.
And of course, we don't really know whether or not that might have happened even if she'd got the R-CHOP alone.
That's exactly right. We don't know.
I guess in the long run, we'll figure that out.
I think in the long run, we'll try to get a sense of whether or not this group of patients as a whole did better than we would have expected with the standard R-CHOP regimen without the bortezomib. And then if it appears that perhaps with the limitations of this sort of study, that this regimen might be doing something better through the addition of bortezomib, we'll go on to study that in larger studies that could potentially more definitively show this.
So when you say that the tumors went away, for example, when you examined her, how long did it take that lymph node in her neck to go away?
It took a couple of weeks for that lymph node to go away. And then when we repeated her scans, they really showed regression or shrinkage of the tumor masses over the course of several months.
When you say regression, was there anything there?
By the end, there was nothing abnormal on her scans.
What about side effects? She lost her hair?
She lost her hair with the treatment. She was admitted to the hospital once with a fever and low blood counts. That occurred despite getting these medications to help boost the white cells. Occasionally, it does happen. But she tolerated that. She was in the hospital for a day or two, was not sick, but was admitted for a fever and low blood counts as a precaution and to get intravenous antibiotics.
Were you able to figure out where the infection was?
Most of the time when these infections happen with low blood counts, there's no clear source. There's no clear place. And in her case, her counts came back up, the fever went away, and we didn't find what caused it.
How long did it take her hair to grow back?
Her hair took several months to grow back, probably in the range of 4 months or so.
What about nausea and vomiting? What did she experience?
She really did not experience much at all in the way of nausea and vomiting. She was very active. She felt a lot better. I mean, many patients are afraid of the side effects of chemotherapy, and that's a reasonable concern. But some patients feel better despite the side effects because the disease gets better and they've been feeling poorly from the disease. And as the disease responds, the patient feels better despite getting treatment or because of getting treatment.
You said she felt fatigued. She didn't really feel very good when mm-hmm. she started the therapy. Of course, then you have the effects of the therapy. Mm-hmm. But overall, as she started to get the treatment, did she feel worse or better?
Overall, she felt better.
She actually felt better.
Yeah, she was going out. She went to social functions and was out, you know, dancing with her husband and with her friends and traveling and doing well.
While she was getting the chemotherapy?
That's right, yes.
Interesting. What was her sort of personal reaction, the reaction of her husband and daughter and family to this whole situation?
Well, I think that they were obviously concerned about the diagnosis and concerned that it was a serious issue to deal with. But she, I think, has been relieved that she's done well and is basically back to her normal life doing her normal things.
Is this sort of a rare case? I mean, have you picked out the patient to discuss who did extraordinarily well, or is this pretty common to see in patients with large diffuse cell lymphoma?
Most patients with large diffuse B-cell lymphoma are cured of their disease, and so this is typical in the way of how patients do. Now, unfortunately, everyone is not cured, and particularly the higher risk group of patients based on those criteria tend not to do as well and tend to have disease that come back more often. But most patients with this type of lymphoma do well and go back to their normal lives afterwards. I think it's important to really have a good handle on what to expect out of the disease. And I think what we would call a risk-adapted approach, which is a technical term, which basically says everybody with this disease is not the same. And yes, some people may do well, some people may do poorly, but everybody's not the same. And the key is to say, within the group of patients with this diagnosis and this disease, what is my individual risk? And sometimes that's the pathology, sometimes that's the doctor looking at the patient, sometimes the scans and the blood work and the laboratory work give you some hints. But the key is really to figure out for an individual patient, what is their particular scenario? Is it average, better than average, worse than average, or just in general? And then what can you do to maximize your outcomes? And I think that clinical trials are a very important part of all of this, because everything that a doctor, everything I've said to you today, and anything a doctor tells a patient comes from clinical trials. Everything we know about lymphoma, every treatment that we use comes from clinical trials. And clinical trials offer patients not only a way to contribute to that knowledge, which is important not only for themselves but for patients coming along, but also offers a patient the possibilities of receiving drugs that, by definition, we don't know exactly if they fully work or how they fully work, but the possibility of perhaps improving outcomes for an individual patient.
Did this woman verbalize to you that part of her motivation was to sort of move the field forward or help other patients?
I think that she felt good about that aspect of things, but I think most importantly, and appropriately so, she was worried about herself, and she looked at this as a way to potentially, not a sure thing, but potentially she was hopeful that this would improve her chances for a good outcome, and she was hopeful that it wasn't going to cause her any other problems, and it hasn't thus far.
It's interesting. I guess really it's going to be years before we really know whether or not, in fact, by her having gone in this trial, she really got a therapy that added benefit. I assume that what's going to happen is at some point you'll have to do an actual randomized study where you compare, for example, something like R-CHOP to this regimen, R-CHOP plus bortezomib. Is that what you think is going to happen in the future?
Well, I think we'll see how these study results go. We're obviously hopeful that this will work well enough and that the signals will be that that's a strategy worth pursuing. These randomized trials, which are the hardest ones for patients to think about because something's taken out of their choice, it's almost a random decision, is really the only way to find out is a new treatment or a tweak on an old treatment better than the standard treatment. And that's something that while people can think they know the answer and try to pick which one is better, there are lots of examples in history and in lymphoma. And in fact, decades ago in lymphoma, there were new regimens that were more toxic. And in fact, everyone thought they were better, but until the randomized trial was done, we didn't know that they were actually no better and in fact more toxic, and therefore we don't use them anymore. So these are important studies to get done.
Now, this woman did have a complication of having to go into the hospital because of the fever and the low blood count. Mm-hmm. How often do you see that with R-CHOP, and do you think it's more commonly by adding in the bortezomib?
We see that with R-CHOP under 5% of the time. It's a little more common in older patients or patients who have problems with their blood counts. It happens a little more commonly the first treatment and less commonly thereafter. That's not been a major problem with the bortezomib addition, but short of a randomized trial, we couldn't really say is it more or less with that particular combination.
You mentioned the growth factors to try to increase the white blood cell count. Was she given that from the beginning?
She was given that from the beginning.
And is that something you routinely do when you give R-CHOP?
It's a debatable thing. I think that the use of the growth factors helps patients in some ways, but it's a debatable thing. And these are expensive treatments that I think are worth considering and need to be talked about, and in many cases can be very helpful to patients. Certain patients, particularly older patients with low blood counts and with the first cycle, are at higher risk. And those tend to be patients where we are more definitive about using that the first time. But it's really an individual decision.